Alright, so we're doing some more stuff in VC++ land. Today we're with, I'll let you introduce yourself.
I'm Louis Lafreniere.
Okay, what do you do on the C++ team?
Work on the compiler backend, so optimization and code generation for C++.
Excellent. So just quickly, so we can reiterate, get people up to speed, C++ has two compilers, right? A front end and a back end. The first one is language. The second one is let's talk about that.
Right. So the front end takes the source code of the program and parses it and tries to find all the errors that might be at the source level, and it transforms the source code into something we call an intermediate language (IL) that is kind of easier for the backend to deal with. And the backend takes the IL, builds its own internal representation of the program that makes it easy to manipulate the program and understand the behavior of the program. Mm-hmm. And then we do optimization at that level, trying to speed up the program. And we do a little bit of analysis, emitting warnings and things like that are not easily done in the front end. Mm-hmm. And then we emit the target machine language, so x86 or x64 or MSIL if we're targeting the CLR.
So what does x86 look like? I mean, what does it understand? I mean, does it look like MSIL, or
it's quite a bit more lower level. So you have register, for example. Mm-hmm. And you have to the machine level assembly is move this piece of memory into this register, add these two registers together, multiply them, and store them back. As MSIL is a state machine, a stack machine, so you push and pop things on a stack. Mm-hmm. And also in the MSIL, there's a lot of the metadata that's associated with a lot of the operations that you do to allow verifiability and things like this. So okay. They're pretty different. And for the compiler to generate MSIL versus assembly is quite different, because we're targeting in terms of optimization. If we're targeting x86, we're targeting, like, we know exactly how things are going to be running. We know like the order of the instruction we're generating and which registers we want to put this thing in. Or for MSIL, we're targeting a compiler. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to lay things in a way that the jitter for the CLR will respond the best and generate the best code out of it. Mm-hmm. So there are things like inlining that we can do. If we can do better inlining than the jitter itself, we can do that ahead of time. But then we have to be careful what do we do exactly with the program and what impact it will have on the jitter itself. Mm. Code generation, the register allocation is a big aspect of that, where the jitter doesn't always do the best thing at register allocation, so we have to be careful when we emit MSIL that we're not going to do things that are going to put a lot of strain on the register allocator and the jitter. Mm. So we have optimization actually to kind of lay things in a way that's going to be easier for the jitter to do a decent job at generating the code.
Now, were you involved with writing the jitter? I mean, in the essence, it's emitting the same stuff in the end, right?
Right. So I haven't been involved with the 32-bit jitter at all, except that I implemented the GS support in the JIT32, actually. Mm. I was the one doing the GS work in the
So can you tell us quickly about GS?
So GS is the checks that we have to detect buffer overruns. Mm. So the first version that we had just put a cookie on the stack between the return address and where the locals are. So if a buffer would overrun, it would stomp on the cookie, and before we load the return address, we go and check that cookie that we put on the stack with the original version of that cookie, and if they don't match, we said it was a buffer overrun, so we abort the process. Hmm. In 7.1, we did some changes where we reordered the layout of the stack such that the buffers were the first thing, such that they don't overrun on the other locals that might be on the stack. And we also added another feature called SafeSCH to protect exception handlers on the frame, that if they get overrun, if the address of on x86, there's, for exception handling, we have a frame that has the address of the handler to call when there's an exception. Mm-hmm. So to protect that handler, we have Safe SCH that makes sure that these handler addresses are valid handler addresses. So that's something we also added in 7.1. And now in WIDB, we added protections for parameters that are also, so the layout of the stack, you have your locals, you have the return address, and then you have the parameters that are passed to that function. So if there's a buffer overrun, mm-hmm. it can go and corrupt the parameters. And if these parameters are used, well, we only check the cookie before returning from the function. So those parameters can be corrupted and then used and can be used in an exploit. Mm-hmm. So what we do is that when we come in a function, we take those parameters and we copy them down below those buffers in local area, and then we use that copy instead of using the original parameter.
Interesting.
So we call that parameter shadowing.
Huh. Now, does that have any performance implications?
It does. So we don't copy all the parameters. We try to detect what parameters might be used in an exploit. So if you just have a Boolean flag, for example, although still corrupting that could trigger some form of exploit, it's less likely than if you have a pointer that you're actually storing at that pointer address. Mm. You could, if a hacker can override that parameter value, you can then change to point it anywhere in memory and override that piece of memory with that pointer write. So we basically, what we look for are things that are used in the address computation of some place where we're going to store in memory. So if you're storing at P plus I, and P and I are both parameters, we're going to shadow both of these. Mm-hmm. But if they're only used to, if you only look at those values to do computations, then we actually leave them in place, so we don't shadow them.
Fantastic. So that's just the WAC GS switch that
yep.
I use?
Yep.
Okay.
So... So the performance impact is it varies a lot also for from one program to another, because we only do the parameter shadowing for functions that have buffers. Mm-hmm. So if your app has a lot of local buffers, you might see a bigger overhead.
Okay.
If you don't have a lot of buffers, then you shouldn't see any.
Sure, but it's probably not going to be so significant. I mean. In the end, you want to guarantee secure
right.
experience.
Right. It's less than 10%, so it's more in the 3 to 7 to 8% range, maybe at the top. But yeah, at the end, security wins.
Certainly, and it's nice to see that it's winning in C++, which
right.
arguably and understandably has pretty much been the culprit of most
yep.
of our problems.
Yes, but and buffer overruns have been a big portion of those, so that's why that's the thing we've been focusing on the most.
Cool. So you're also, you know, integer overflows and stuff like this are protected against?
So, no. Well, uh-huh. we did some minor improvements in WIDB. The size computation of new, if you do new of an array, there's some computation that's introduced by the compiler to for the element size of the array and some other things that might be allocated at the same time as you allocate this array. Mm-hmm. And we actually now do integer overflow checks for those computations that are introduced by the compiler. But we don't have any protection for the user computation. That's something we might look at in the future, but haven't quite yet.
Okay. So you are specifically working on the back-end compiler, and mm-hmm. you, and it sounds like there's been a lot of changes, a lot of improvements from
yep.
7.1 to 8, is that, or let's say from 1.1 to 2.0 as far as the framework, like 2005, 2003 to 2005. I get all the numbers mixed
right.
up. So the latest version, WIDB.
There
we go.
Yeah. Yes, 2005.
So from Everett to WIDB, right?
Yeah.
What are some of the core changes you've made in the back end that will improve optimization?
Right. So for native compilation, we probably the biggest one is POGO, Profile Guided Optimization.
Hmm.
So we added the ability for you to instrument your application and run it over a scenario that's common, and we gather profile info on that application. and then we reuse the, you recompile your app a second time, and now we use the data that we collected during the profiling. And that allows a lot of optimizations that you can't do without the profiling. For example, one of the most significant ones is that we'll take all of your hot code and put it all together, all that code adjacent to each other, and all the cold code we'll put somewhere else in the image. So when you're running, you're keeping your cache hot, and all the pages that are loaded contain all your hot code. We'll also determine for you what code should be compiled for speed versus size. So all the hot code will be compiled for speed, and the cold code to minimize paging and all that is compiled for size. We can improve the inlining decisions because we know which call path are hot. And any optimization in the compiler that's heuristic based can be improved basically using the profile info. We've also done some improvement to the LTCG optimization, the whole program optimization.
Okay.
So it's what we call link time cogen. The way link time cogen works is so we have the front end that runs, produces IL. Then the backend is called, and that pass of the backend, when we're doing LTCG, so you compile with /GL, takes all that IL from the front end and puts it in the object file. So instead of doing the real compilation at that time and putting ASM code in the object, we actually just put the IL. And then when the linker is called to link all the objects together, any of them that contain IL, the linker passes them to the backend. And the backend does the code generation at link time. And the advantage of that is that we have the whole, anything that was compiled GL, we have in our scope all at the same time. Instead of just seeing one module at a time, we can see the whole program. The linker can also tell us that if we have a function foo, it can tell us that function foo is not called by any of the other objects or libraries that are being linked with. So you can change the calling convention, do anything you want with it. And so we introduced LTCG in VC 7.0, so VS.NET, and then we improved it in 2003, and then we've added some significant improvement in 2005. What we added was basically the way we do the code generation for the program is that we generate a call tree of everything that's in our scope, all the functions. So foo calls bar, and bar calls this function.
Okay.
We generate the call tree, and then we start the code gen at the bottom with all the leaf functions. And after we've done the code generation for a function, we gather information about what that function has. So this function uses these registers, doesn't use these, or it's touching. This function doesn't write to memory. It just returns value based on its input. Any kind of characteristic that can be useful for optimization, like information for the inliner to use when we're going to see a call to that function, is gathered during that time, and then we just move up on the call tree. And with LTCG now, what we do is that we do one pass over the whole call tree, actually, that looks at all these functions but doesn't generate code. It just do analysis about what's in those functions and propagates that up to the call tree. And then we do a top-down pass where we push information down the call tree about all the parameters for the functions. And then we do the final cogen pass bottom-up that's using the information we collected in those previous two paths. So we actually visit the program three times, the whole program basically three times before we actually do the code generation.
Wow.
And that allows us to do a lot of optimization that we were not able to do before, like if a function is always passed this value as one of its parameter, we'll just get rid of the parameter and use that value when we do the cogen for that actual function. Yeah, it really improves the inlining decision and a lot of other information like this that we can use to generate better code.
Since you used the term decision, the question is, first, there's two questions. What did you write the back end in, right? And what optimizes that code?
Right.
And sort of the circular reference. And then also, What else was I going to ask? Well, we can just start with that, the second one.
So the backend is actually mostly written in C.
Okay.
I've been working on that backend for a long time, actually. I've been working on it for 15 years now.
15? At Microsoft?
At Microsoft.
Wow.
On the 32-bit backend. I started at Microsoft. I was hired to work on the first compiler backend for 32-bit.
Wow.
And that one was written all in C, of course. And in about 95, for VC5.0, we totally rewrote the backend at that point. And there was a lot of debate whether it should be written in C or in C++. Hmm. And there was a lot of old timers and they wanted to use C. So we actually rewrote the whole thing in C again.
Wow.
But there's some C++ code now. Some of the newer code has been written in C++.
And now let's talk about that. I mean, because it's interesting. What was the advantage of C? I mean, C++, you get objects, exceptions, you get a nicer model, don't you?
I think it was mainly from those old-timer guys being compiler guys, we want performance. We want our code to be fast. And C just hides a lot less you know exactly what's happening in C. You're in control of everything. In C++, there's a lot of things that are hidden. And I think it's that fear that people had of not having our code being fast because of all these things that are hidden.
Okay.
But that was 10 years ago. Uh-huh. And speed is not quite as important as it used to be. And also we've just learned a lot about C++. And now we're writing a lot more code in C++, and at the same time we're learning how to do better C++ optimization. I think in the end we should have written it in C++ just to better tune the compiler for C++ and understand it ourselves better.
Absolutely. Since you're compiling C++.
Right. And we're rewriting a new compiler framework now called Phoenix, and that one is all written in C++.
Yes.
So.
I had a conversation with Jim Hogg a couple weeks ago.
Right.
As part of the series that will be on Channel 9.
Right.
That's a fantastic piece of engineering.
Right. So we have NRVO, for example, is one optimization we added in Whitby. That's a very C++ optimization. Probably something we should have had a long time ago. But it's for when you return an object by value. The standard way of doing that is typically your function will create an object locally in the stack and mm-hmm. fill up all the value for that object and set it up, and then you want to return that object. Well, to return it, you have to call a copy constructor to copy it to the return site, and then you destroy the local object. So what NRVO does is that you, instead of creating a local object that you're going to have to copy, why not just create the object you're going to return in the first place? So we actually just save one object construction and destruction. It's a pretty useful optimization.
Excellent. And so 15 years working on the back end.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So what brought you to Microsoft, just out of curiosity?
I was in college and I'm from Quebec. I'm French Canadian.
All right.
And so I got a job offer from Microsoft, and I'm like, well, yeah, moving to the West Coast, moving to the United States, that'll be fun. I could try that for 2 or 3 years, and then come back home, and kind of fell in love with the Northwest and with Microsoft and compilers. I didn't know all that much about compilers before, but it ended up being right into the kind of computer science work that I like, which is with compilers, everything is pretty low level, and there's a lot of some pretty hard algorithm to solve and hard problems, and also we're kind of like we control our own most of our environment. We're not dependent on a lot of outside DLLs, and except when we're targeting the CLR, man, this is a new world where we're not in 100% control of our world.
Sure.
But those are pretty much the things that I really like about compiler work.
Excellent. Now let's, going back to the second question I was going to ask, which is based on the decision algorithms that you're doing
mm-hmm.
In the compiler. So how does that work? Like, where is the thinking stored? In other words, you're going through this code, you're understanding that, you know, this happens, and which could invoke this, which means that may be better if I put it all in this place.
Right.
That's an algorithm. That's thinking, in a sense. What form does that take? That's really what I'm asking.
Well, we have data structures to store that info. So we have the compiler. There's probably the three main data structures is the IR, which is the representation of the current function that we have. Mm. And then there's the symbol table, which is the information about all the symbols and function, all the global variables, all the functions and the local variable. And then we have a call tree, which tells us who calls who and about all the different call sites in the program. Mm. So a lot of the whole program information, for example, is all stored in the call tree so that we can visit the call tree and figure out all that info. When we have a function call and there's a bunch of different callees, then we know all the info about those functions. Mm. But it's basically a matter of finding the right algorithm and the right data structure to then encode the information and process it. Mm. And there's a lot of compiler research that has been done, so that's also useful. We go look at research paper and see what has been done.
Totally.
And
of course, you have to target multiple platforms, right?
Yep.
So and that's a challenge.
We basically have four platforms. We have x86, x64, IS64, and then the CLR. And I'm not talking about all the WinC platforms that our team doesn't actually do, but they're using our compiler framework, our compiler, to actually implement those targets. Mm-hmm. And Xbox.
So what's the most challenging platform to target?
IS64 for sure.
IS64.
Yeah.
Okay.
IS64 is very complex architecture. And also the architecture is designed to rely a lot on the compiler to do the smarts. Mm-hmm. So on x86, the chip will reorder instructions before they actually, as they're being processed, to maximize the throughput in the machine. It also, the x86 language has really few, very few registers. But internally inside the machine, there's a lot of registers, and the machine will rename, if you define a register and use it and redefine it again, mm-hmm. it will use two different physical registers to represent those, such that these instructions can then be reordered independently. Mm-hmm. On IS64, everything is sequential inside the CPU, and everything is relied on the compiler to lay things out in a way to maximize the throughput in the machine. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the challenge, but also there's functionality in the machine that that are fairly hard to take advantage of, but you kind of want to take advantage of to have the full potential of the machine. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you can hoist loads that would normally you would not be able to hoist them because their value might change because of another write in the system, and which is called aliases. So you have a star P load and there's a star Q store, mm-hmm. and you don't know if P and Q point to the same thing. You'd like to move that load up such that the memory has been read by the time you're going to consume it, but normally you wouldn't be able to do that. On I-64, you have a way to do an advanced load, which says, well, just do that load, and if that store happens to store the same memory, we'll invalidate the load, and it'll get redone when you actually need the value. But if it doesn't actually store the same location, the memory will be read and available. Hmm. And there's also a way to, like, if you have if X use star P, normally we wouldn't be able to hoist star P out of that if, because that the if might be protecting against against an exception. Mm. But there's a way to hoist that star P and say, well, if there's an exception, wait until inside the if to actually take the exception. And if you don't go in the if, you never take the exception. Mm. So there's a lot of mechanics like that in the chip that allow a lot of functionality that allows to really take advantage of the chip, but there's always trade-offs when you use these things. They're all machine resources, and you have to make the right decision. If you hoist all the loads up at the beginning of the program, mm-hmm. you're just going to be like doing load, and then there's a bunch of them. You're only going to use a few. Well, you didn't do the right optimization.
Sure.
So you have to have the right trade-offs. There's a lot of other mechanics like that. There's a way to have all instructions can be conditionally executed based on a predicate that is set by something else. So you can take complex if-else construct and flatten them out into linear constructs that are just, depending on the predicate, these instructions are going to get executed or not, to avoid having a lot of branches in your code. Mm. There's a lot, and that architecture is very complex and really relies on the compiler to do the right decisions.
Mm-hmm. So, interesting. Well, it sounds like it gives you a lot of power.
It does give us...
And also a lot of headaches, huh?
Yeah, a lot of headaches and a lot of power, and it makes it certainly very challenging.
Cool. So, see here. Have there been any improvements in exception handling in
so,
PS 2005?
Yeah, we did some improvement for code that is inside a try block for SCH constructs, so try except, try finallys, and also for try blocks with when you compile with EHA. We were not doing very good there, assuming the compiler pretty much assumed that inside a try block an exception can happen at any point inside the try block. Mm-hmm. And to be conservative, any store to memory is any store to a variable is always stored to memory in case you get an exception and that value is used afterwards. So we did better this time where we did the analysis of like, well, that is that variable, can it really be used after if there was an exception, instead of just blindly copying them all to memory. Mm-hmm. And that did improve the code inside TryBlock quite a bit. And we also turned on stack packing for functions that had these try blocks. Mm-hmm. Nothing has changed so much for EHS, which is the most common form that people use of exception handling. But that's because we are already doing pretty well there in terms of optimization. Mm-hmm. EHA is more challenging to do well because we don't really know where these exceptions... There's so many different points inside the try block where an exception can happen. Mm-hmm. With EHS, we just have to worry about an explicit call to throw or a call to a function that might be calling throw somewhere else. So there's very few exception points compared to EHA.
Now, what about like in the backend optimizations of multi-threaded code? Right, so if you have a synchronous thread and an exception happens,
right,
that information back to the function.
So C and C++ are kind of defined as really single thread languages. So we rely pretty much on the programmer to do all the work for multi-threading. Mm-hmm. We did modify our definition of volatile to help people doing multi-threading code, where a store to a volatile has acquire semantic, mm-hmm. so it's kind of like acquiring a log. So we're not gonna hoist any loads above that store, and a use of a volatile variable as release semantic. So we're not gonna push anything down past a use of a volatile. Actually, is it the reverse? I think I might have gotten those confused, but
okay.
So that's the main thing. Multi-cores and multi-threading is something we're looking more now actively. Mm-hmm. But they're really hard problems to solve.
Absolutely.
So I'm not sure when exactly we'll have good solutions for that.
Yeah. Well, it's an industry-wide issue.
Right.
Right.
It totally
so you're gonna
is.
Want help from the people actually making the multi-cores to,
right,
to offer some assistance to the compiler people.
Yep. And language, making the language more flexible for being able to make it easier to write multi-threaded apps.
Yeah.
And debugging and analysis.
That's actually one of the biggest problems with debugging.
Yes. Yep.
Right? How do you know where the exception happened?
Exactly.
When?
And the fact that problems are not reproducible in a lot of the cases, which is the harder part.
Well, it's a really, you know, you have another 15 years. So
yep,
really
still a lot of work ahead.
Problem. So you've been a software development engineer for 15 years at Microsoft.
Yep.
And you love writing code.
Yep.
Have you ever managed a team, or you've always been just writing code for compiling?
I did. I was in charge of the x86 compiler team for quite a few years.
Okay.
And then actually kind of the beginning of would be I went back to being individual contributor, and now I'm actually working on Phoenix, so I'm actually not working on the current product.
Okay.
So.
Well, Phoenix is, you know, as I mentioned, we talked to Jim Hogg, it's very interesting.
Right. Yeah.
And it actually offers, it's a platform, right? So it's going to offer compiler people like you to extend.
Right.
Right?
Phoenix is really, it's a lot more than just a compiler, and it makes it a lot more challenging to design, because there's so many different applications for Phoenix. Mm. So there's the compilers, there's for jitters or pre-jitters, and then there's for all the analysis tools that can plug in into Phoenix and use Phoenix as the framework for doing analysis, either at the program level or at the binary level. So it's a And writing something that is a framework is always a lot more challenging than writing something that's designed for one specific purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you have to, you know, develop APIs that people can use.
Right.
Right? People can't use your APIs, the private APIs that you're using in the back-end compiler, right?
Right.
For VC, I mean, obviously.
Yeah, and a lot of the code we have, like, it works a certain way, and it works for a certain kind of input, and that's the only thing we need to worry about. But once you start to have to worry about all the different combinations that you might get at your inputs, it becomes a lot more challenging.
Now, in terms of your customers, you know, clearly, do you get a lot of feedback from people about the optimizations that you're doing? I mean, there's going to be engineers out there that are interested enough at that level.
Right.
And they'll provide input back to you. How do they do it?
So, our customer base is really broad. There's a lot of people that don't really care that much about performance at this point. Mm-hmm. So they care about the compiler being fast. They care about having like tools like JS to help them protect for security, or the RTC checks that we have to help their app being stable. Mm-hmm. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we have the hardcore system level guys that are really care about every little cycle. A lot of the big ISVs or the some of the internal groups at Microsoft, like the NT team and the SQL team, they really care about performance. Mm-hmm. Or guys doing multimedia player. A lot of the game developers always care about squeezing that last little piece of performance to get better graphics or anything.
And so how do they, I guess the other way to ask the question would be, how do they help you optimize their code better? And I'm not necessarily talking about sending you an email and giving you a stack dump or something, or whatever, you know, you'll be able to understand about where you could be not optimizing correctly, which that wouldn't be the case, but what can they do?
We get feedback from people like, I've got this construct that we use a lot, and the code that you generate is not optimal. You could do this and this and this. And a lot of the time we go back and it's like, well, we can't do that because we're not allowed because there's aliasing here or there's something going on. Mm-hmm. But a lot of other cases, we just get a lot of new ideas this way that, this is something that'd be interesting to do, and try to see if it's hard or not. Yeah. I think it's, in terms of the compiler, we have like this big list of things we know we can do, and it's just like, as we go over the years, it's like trying to expand the scope of all the optimizations that that we can do. A lot of them are hard to implement. A lot of hard to implement well. Mm-hmm. And also, there's always the compile time restriction that we don't want to take weeks to compile your application. So it's always a balance of like, what's the cost benefit? Like, mm-hmm. How hard is it going to be to implement this optimization? How much benefit we're going to get out of it, and how much compile time is it going to cost?
So are you doing? I mean, clearly you're working with people over in research, mm-hmm. right? I mean, because this is pretty much computer science,
right.
What you're doing,
right?
And so as the backend compiler evolves over time, do you see there being maybe more kind of machine thinking involved in this, or some sort of quote unquote intelligence? So what do you see as the evolution of the backend compiler? What I'm getting at.
Right. Well, I think the area, clearly the idea where the area where we have the most potential for adding optimization is in the whole program scenario. And so, I mean, I don't think we're at the point of like having neural networks trying to make your decisions. In the whole program scenario, there's a lot of potential there, and there's a lot of things we haven't done yet that that we certainly would like to do in the future. Mm-hmm. For example, object-oriented optimization. So trying to get rid of virtual calls, turn them into static calls. When we can tell that we see the whole program and we know that this can only call that version of this virtual function.
Mm. And what's the benefit there?
Well, a virtual call is an indirect call, so okay. you have to load the value of the address that you're gonna call and then call it. So there's an extra load involved. At the CPU level, this is it's a lot harder to predict where a indirect call is going to go than a direct call. Mm. With the history, they're able to do some prediction on those, but it's still a lot more expensive than doing a real call. But I think even more than at the machine level, it's the fact that the compiler cannot do a very good job optimizing when there's those virtual calls, because we don't know if we don't know where that call is going to go, we can't make any assumptions about this call. If we did, we'd replace it by a static call. And since we don't know, well, we can't do inlining of that function. And all these whole program optimization I was talking about cannot be done on these functions. We don't know all the call sizes to those virtual functions are. And when we have a call to that virtual function, we don't know exactly what piece of code is gonna run afterwards. So I think the optimization impact is probably one of the bigger impact. So being able to replace those by static calls really helps. Pogo actually does help there, because with Pogo we'll try to determine if one of those virtual calls is like almost always going to that same target, mm-hmm. and if it does, we'll rewrite we'll do the real code gen after Pogo. We'll rewrite the code to be, if the target is equal to this, call this make the static call, mm-hmm. else do the virtual call. And the static call now can be in line, and we can do the optimization on that one. So now you just pay if that call is in fact the one you were going to call, you just pay the one, the direct branch, and then you have the call that can be in line.
So what does the if else construct look like in x86? I mean, what does it look like? Because right. I mean, you're talking about talking to a processor, right?
Right.
So the pretty little squigglies and the syntax that we're used to way up in programmer land.
Right.
So what is it like, a simple construct like that? If this, do this. What would that look like?
So typically, ifs are not just if this. So that's one of the issue. They usually it's if this or this and this.
Exactly.
And so for every one of these construct, there's a compare branch pair that's being generated on x86 and x64. Mm-hmm. And so you basically end up, you have two values that you compare for equality or greater than or something like that. That sets a condition flag that tells you the properties of what happened when those two values were compared. Mm-hmm. And then there's a branch that uses that condition flag, and it's depending what kind of compare you were doing. If you're looking for equality, there's an equality bit that's set, or greater or something like that. So we test these flags, mm-hmm. and then we, if the branch is true, it goes to the target, otherwise it just keeps going. Mm-hmm. So for an if statement, you have the true path, we'll have the code right there for the true path, and the else path would be at the target of the branch. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the if sequence of block, you'll have a direct jump that will jump over the else part. Mm-hmm. And then it will meet back at the bottom.
Interesting. So it's really, when you say if the condition is met, it's just a linear list of instructions.
Yeah.
That processor do this, processor do that.
Exactly.
Allocate this memory or perform right. this computation, which is going to actually hit mm-hmm. a sub-processor, right? The mm-hmm. mathematic, the number cruncher.
Right.
So it's all just a matter of just machine instructions.
Yep.
That just the processor is asked to perform.
Right.
And then returns back to you something.
And the reason, that's the thing, the region branches sometimes are problematic in the chip is that the chip has a lot of instructions it's processing in flight. Mm-hmm. And when it gets to a branch, it has to try to make a decision. Well, it can stop there and just wait for all the other instructions to finish such that it knows exactly where that branch is going to go. Mm-hmm. Or it can start fetching, make decision one of the two paths this branch might go and start fetching some of these instructions. Mm-hmm. And if the prediction is right, then that branch is pretty much free. Mm-hmm. But if it's wrong, it has to undo all these instructions, mm-hmm. flush them out, and then start on the other path that it didn't think was the right path.
Interesting.
And again, Pogo can actually help there by reordering those branches to make sure that the path that's most likely to be taken is going to be the one that the chip is going to choose, at least the first time it sees that code.
That's a very good point. I mean, the chip does runtime optimizations as well.
Right. So for branch prediction, there's static branch prediction, there's dynamic branch prediction. So the first time the chip sees a branch, it has to make a static decision whether that branch should be taken or not. And mm-hmm. the algorithm they usually use is that if the branch is branching up in the code, it's probably a loop, and loops usually iterate a few times, so it'll assume that branch is taken. If it's a forward branch, it'll assume it's not taken, that it falls into the code. So for us, if we can lay out the code such that static branch prediction can be accurate, it can help. Mm. But then the machine also record history about these branches such that the second time it sees that branch again, it will have information whether, like if last time that branch was taken, well, there's a good chance it'll be taken again. But sometimes branches follow a pattern of like taken, not taken, taken, not taken, and it will actually remember that history and figure out these patterns. So there's a lot of smarts that is put in the chips for these
totally.
Things.
Now, would you say that your interaction between the front-end people mm-hmm. and the chip people are about the same? I mean, you're working with them in the same, because you're like right in the middle of
right.
of the higher end folks who
right.
pass on to you something, and then
yeah.
the lower end.
So it depends what we're working on. Uh-huh. Well, the front end team is working for Microsoft. The chip guys are not working for Microsoft, so there's a little difference there.
Got that.
But we do have people from Intel and uh-huh. AMD actually in house helping us and actually working on a compiler with us.
Cool.
But it just depends what we're currently working on. If we're working on performance and we're working on some low-level thing, then yeah, we'll be interacting with the chip people. If we're working on a feature that's more language-based or some new functionality for the compiler, we're a lot more likely to talk to the front end or the library guys, too, the
sure.
CRT guys.
So, but now when we move into the world of multi-core, it seems like you're going to have the language folks, and I'm including them in the front end,
mm-hmm.
and then you,
right.
and then the multi-core chip makers, whoever they are,
right.
that we want to target.
Yep.
You're going to be doing a lot of work together, right?
Yep.
I think
the place where we have the most work to do is at the language level, because yeah, again, C, C++ are designed to be single thread, and anything that's multi-threaded, it's like, it's mm-hmm. not our fault.
Sure. So
it's totally in the hands of the programmer right now, and yeah. I think that's something where we really need to help mm-hmm. programmer making it easier to write multi-threaded code.
So, and be able to target the power of multi-core, right?
Right, right.
And that's, so clearly, and at some point in time, I'm sure there's something interesting that we'll be able to talk about on Channel 9 regarding language enhancements. We already had a conversation in the managed world. There's a really kind of mm-hmm. elegant solution with, well, it's not a solution. It's actually, it's a very interesting idea. It's port-based. It's called the coordination and concurrency runtime. It's a port-based model where you don't directly work with threads in your code. Right. You don't think of it that way. You think of it as opening a port and telling it to do something, and you're writing code basically that looks like it's in line and not really having to worry about it. Takes care of all the plumbing for you. Right. Some great work that's been done, and they're part of the robotics team right now.
Actually, you're asking me if we did anything for multi-threading, and I did forget one important feature that we did, which is OpenMP. We did have OpenMP support to WIDBI.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean?
So OpenMP is language features actually to help writing multi-thread programs. So you can set a loop, you can mark a loop as being a parallel loop that can be done in parallel, and you tell the runtime some property about which variables are shared and which ones should be private. Mm-hmm. And you can also do it over a bigger region of code.
Okay.
It doesn't make it, I wouldn't say it removes all the problems with doing multi-threading. One of the bigger advantages of OpenMP is that it's portable across platform. Mm-hmm. It's a standard and it is portable.
Sure.
So it allows you to write your source code and not making it be Windows dependent. And it's also a slightly more elegant syntax than just calling Win32 APIs. Mm. But that's the thing. I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done to make it easier to avoid the pitfall of multi-threading.
Sure. But I mean, for example, when you're a compiler developer or a kernel developer, you kind of have a really excellent understanding and of locks and stuff like that. Right. I mean, you're an engineer to a degree where, I mean, you live and breathe. I mean, you're definitely writing multi-threaded code in the back-end compiler.
Actually,
I would imagine.
Not.
You're not.
We're not.
What? So in other words, when you are calling an algorithm to do, so in other words, you're doing everything in line.
Yep, and it's. Why is that?
I just out of curiosity.
Wouldn't
it be faster to have?
It would be. I mean, one of the things is, I mean, for the past few years and, I mean, releases of the product, we've been doing a lot of work for managed code, and it's been a big focus of our work, and it's just a matter of priorities.
Sure.
So we've done a lot of work for managed, and that's taken a lot of the time for the team, and then we wanted to still progress on native code and add some features and add some performance, and changing the backend to be multi-threaded is certainly a feature we'd love to do, but it's been competing with other features at the same time.
Sure.
But we had a summer intern actually that started porting making the compiler multi-threaded, and
we were
supposed to finish it, and then that part of that work item got cut, and we never ended up finishing it.
Sure.
But for link time cogen, it's where it would really pay off. Where at that culture level, when I was saying we compile all the leaf of the program, so instead of making the algorithms that we have multi-threaded, what we would do is we would compile two independent functions at the same time, and it'd be
pretty interesting.
It would really help the compile time, especially for optimized builds.
Well, I mean, that'll be something to target in the future. I mean, it's an interesting idea.
Yeah, incoming feature. I don't know when, but eventually we'll have a multi-threaded compiler for sure. I mean, Phoenix is multi-threaded now, so we're working in that direction, but yeah, it just competes with other features right now.
And we always say towards the end of these interviews you've been doing with your team is, I mean, your team, particularly you guys, you're optimizing Windows.
Right.
You're optimizing Office, you're optimizing SQL, you're optimizing all these applications that everybody uses, i.e. everything.
Yep.
That is pretty amazing. That must make you feel sort of proud.
Yeah, that's what I see when we, if we do some optimization that speeds code by 2%, we're speeding like all of Windows code, all of Office code, all these things at the same time. We add a feature like JS to improve security that spreads that security benefit all across the board.
Fantastic. So. Well, great. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And great job.
Thank you.
And hope you stay for another 15 years
okay.
to come up with some other great stuff. And thank you for your time.
Okay.
Take care. Welcome.